But anyway, this year's cycle has been quite a time. One year there were 7A technicians quit and went somewhere else that had seniority on me. And I was able to stay. I always used to wonder why I couldn't get onto the sugar factory full time. I could train somebody, help train somebody, and then they'd get the job, the steady job, and I didn't. But I never really knew, and I probably still don't. But the sugar factory has come and gone. I remember when President Neely called me in the spring of 1960 and asked me if I'd serve as a high councilman. I told him I was working at Thiokol and there'd be times I couldn't get to the Thursday night meeting, but I'd do my very best. And he said, that's good enough. And he said, what in the world are you doing out to Thiokol? And I said, well, I needed a job. Ray and Glenn had got up big enough that they could milk the cows. And when I couldn't get there, they were real dependable kids. And I said, and I had to have more money. Outside of my family, I'm just not making it. He said, yeah, but what'd you leave the sugar factory for? And I said, well, I only worked there about 3 months a year, and that wasn't enough. He said, well, you've gone out there with that fly-by-night outfit, and it won't last. And I said, well, the last 5 years is better than what I've had. Well, I haven't thought about that. Thiokol's still going after 20 years, and sugar factory shut down and moved and gone. And I know along those years about while I was on the High Council, Frank Lamb was assistant manager of Sago Milk over in Richmond. He said, why don't you come? There's a job opening and be interviewed for it. And I said, what's it pay? And he told me, and I said, I'd have to take a cut in pay by half. I make twice that much at the Thiokol. And I'm not going to go be interviewed for a job with half pay. And he said, well, don't blame you. But we're a little more secure than that. And a year later, Sago Milk left. So it's kind of, I must have been led by some source to where I went, to what I'm doing, so that I could have a good job all these years I sent in these kids on missions. Now, while I'm on this subject, I might just as well finish my term at Thiokol in what I put on this tape. As it's motored along, I got up to be an A technician, and now their pay structure out there is such that I'm an hourly man, and so I come under the Taft-Hartley law, which seniority helps. The only other basis above that is a group leader slot. But to go exempt where your chemists and so forth are, you go into management. They're a salaried person and they don't come under the Taft-Hartley law, and seniority don't mean a thing. And I didn't have a chemistry degree, so I never wanted to go exempt. I was content with the hour. The best slot out there is group leader slot. And over the years, and I'm going to tell this, and so if some of you run into it in your own time, you'll know it may help you. But I had run a shift for a good 10, 12 years as an A technician, responsible for what went on, no extra pay. Finally, all one day, in the heat of battle, I guess, they decided to make 3 group leaders in our section. So they dropped me out as shift leader and put Neil Reed in on my shift to be the group leader and dropped me out. Didn't drop me out, they just didn't give me the job. Now, Neil was a good, hard-working boy. good hard work man. He'd been there almost a year longer than I had. He had a degree from college, I believe, in dairy production or something. He's all right. He does fine. I get along fine with him. He and I work good together. I have no objection to that. The other two group leaders I objected to. And I'd seen shafts all my life. I'd never been promoted for some reason or another. Everybody thought I was just a common ordinary guy that done the work and somebody else had to do the telling. Sometimes those things are hard to take, and so I thought it over for a week or two, and finally summoned Delmar that I'd like to talk to him to come through. I was in M9B, which had been my home for many years, out to work. I'd built up most of the equipment, I'd remodeled it. I had a good reputation. If my name was on the data, it was accepted. And I told Delmar, I said, you've robbed me. All these years I've worked for you. I've worked for you as long as you've been a supervisor. Now when you get around to paying a man to run the shift, you drop me out and put Neil in over my shift. Now, he's always worked day shift. He's had a better deal than the rest of us. I knew he was the fair-haired bud. But I can see why you put him ahead of me, but I can't see why you put Paul Nielsen or Lloyd Bunderson ahead of me. Now, that's the lowest blow I've ever had out of you or anybody else, putting those guys ahead of me. I thought I'd said enough, and so I stopped. And he get up and paced around the room. I guess I had him in a position that he couldn't answer. And he said, I hope you don't take this personal. I thought, well, how do you do it any other way? That's all he said. Left. I told Orrin Baird the same thing, same speech. He didn't answer either. I couldn't seem to find an answer. Now, Grant Thompson was the manager of the development lab, and Grant and I, he's a few years younger than I am, but we visit not on technical matters. He's in the stake presidency, he's been a bishop, and he's now in the stake presidency, and he and I just visit just to be visiting at times. Then I said to Grant one night, I was out there as he was getting in his car and I was on swing shift, and I told him how I felt about this. And I told him what I'd told Delmar and what I'd told Baird, and he looked at me and kind of laughed and said, what did they say? And I said, they didn't really answer. And he said, you had them in a position they couldn't answer. Now, lots of times people get in that situation that they just can't answer. And so he knew the answer, but he wouldn't answer either. So there didn't seem to be an answer that I could get. Now, this bothered me for a long time. And I even looked around out there for other jobs. I didn't want to leave Thiokol. I had enough years in it. I had about 18 years in it then. And I was getting old enough, and I had seen people over the years that when you get up approaching age 60, that they start bypassing you. And I wasn't sure whether that was the reason I was being bypassed or whether it was the reason or some other reason that I couldn't find. But I couldn't find an answer. And this bothered me. Now, over the years at Thiokol, I'd always defended the bosses. I have to be about half cheerful and work A lot of people, their enjoyment in working is grumbling. And I can't do that. I'm not built that way. And so, for the last 2 years, it's been pretty tough. I've had a hard time consoling myself and straightening myself out. And I was a little upset at my conduct. I didn't kick up any fuss, but at my feelings, and I couldn't get my feelings straight. I've had mixed emotions about this. But along this last winter, I saw a cartoon of an old man sitting down in a nice easy chair and leant back, kind of relaxed, and he said, "You know, I feel better since I give up hope." And I had to turn that over in my mind many times before I caught the full impact of that. There's things in life that you can't have. There's things that you want with all your heart that you just don't get. That you just can't, no matter what you do, you just can't get them. And so if you give up hope on those things, you'll feel better. And since I've decided that, I've felt a little better about it. Now, out to work right now, the man that runs the desk. I run the desk 1 year for Delmore. He'd had a couple of men do it that had done a real poor job. There was 5 full drawers, file cabinets, full of data that just hadn't been logged out properly and hadn't been done. Nobody could find it. They didn't know where it was. And they didn't know what it was. And they brought me in on the desk and I straightened that out in a year, and then they took me out of the desk and back out in the lab, and it's jostled around between a few people, and Brent Crosby's had it the last few years, and he's done just exactly like those other guys did. He's got boxes stacked up with data that just hasn't been finished, and he hasn't done a very good job of it. But he's applied now to be an engineer, and I imagine he's qualified. I tell him he is. I tell him he's got the right disposition to be an engineer, but anyway. So I thought that over, and I went to Del Mar 2 weeks ago and said, "Now, Del, I understand Crosby is trying to transfer out to be an engineer." And he said, "That's right." I said, "With him vacating that desk, I would take it if you'd give it to me. I've got, 5.5 years left of THIOCOL, and I'd be content on that desk for that length of time. It's straight days. I could do my ecclesiastical work. I'm now in the bishopric. And I could do that a little easier on straight days." And Del said, "Well, by golly, I'm almost supposed to just take you right over there and give it to you." And I said, "Now look, I'm not crowding him out. If he goes, the job's available. I'm not going to crowd anybody out." And so now the rumor is, last night, 2 weeks after, 2 weeks, the rumor is that I have the job, but I haven't got it yet, but it would be nice to have, I think. When I was on that desk before, after I had got the job done and got it completed, they switched Carl Lundahl to replace Baird as running the... Baird was the unit chief in charge of the technicians at the time when I had the desk before. Baird was off work a lot of times that year. That was quite a year. I just about got the desk straight of what was going on and what to do. One day Delmar wasn't there, and Baird was rushed to the hospital that morning. They had to operate on him and cut out, his stomach had come through on ulcers, and they had to do that stomach operation on him, and he didn't show up to work for about a month. And, well, with Delmar gone, why, Wendell Christensen, commonly known as the Horse, run around there and gave everybody instructions. The next morning, he was giving everybody instructions, and I was seated at that desk trying to get the paperwork straight. And Delmar walked in, and I felt somebody take a hold of my shoulder, and I looked up, and he said, "You run the section and delegate the work and pass out the work. Chris could do his own work." Turned around and left. I looked up, and there was Chris. He'd gone over and sat down at his desk, and he looked like he had been just beat. And he sat there and pouted most of the day. Anyway, went on for a day or two, and I was keeping the work straight and signing out the work. I went back in room 19 and asked Paul Nielsen and Clyde Poppleton if they wanted some overtime the next morning. And they both in unison said, "Can you give out overtime?" And I said, "Go to hell." And turned around and walked off and left him and headed down the hall, hunting for somebody else to bring in the next morning for overtime. And those two run down the hall and caught me and said, "Yeah, we'll take some overtime." And I said, "Don't be giving me any nonsense. I haven't got time." But anyway, it went on, and that was quite an experience. While Baird was gone, and he'd come, and then he was so sick when he got back, he'd go hide. I'd hide him in a place where he could sleep and get his rest. Nobody'd know it. Nobody'd catch him. Anyway, one day, while Baird was gone, why, Delmar said to me, "Now, Lindsay," he said, "I won't be here for a couple of days. And this is the charge number to put on my time card." "That's all right." And I said, "If you run into problems, Mr. Brandt, Bill Brandt, was the department head under John McDermott that we worked for then. He'll give you help. You go to him and he'll help you." I said, "All right." And so the next morning I signed out the work, and I was going down the hall to check on something, and right in front of Bill Brandt's office, Wendell Christensen said, "Where's Delmar?" And I said, "I don't really know where he is, but he's not coming today." And Wendell said, "Well, why didn't he tell me?" And I said, "I don't have the foggiest idea why he didn't tell you." And as I looked over Chris's shoulder, there was Bill Brandt standing right behind him. But I said, "Now, Wendell, if you don't have anything to do, I could find a job for you." And at that, he fussed and fumed and went on down the hall. Bill says, "Do you need help with him?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." "Well," he said, "I'm here if you need help with him. I can just happen to do that." And I said, "I kind of enjoyed that." And he said, "Well, it looked like maybe you did." But anyway, after a year on the desk, they switched and put Carl and Dahl in Baird's place. Baird did not really recover from that operation very good. Well, they took me off the desk. Dell said he needed me out in the lab. I kidded Carl about firing me, but anyway. And they put one person on the desk. I guess it was Dorothy Reese that came on the desk to replace me somewhere around the 1st of July that year, and I don't really know which year, but anyway. And in a matter of about a month, she transferred out to a better job. She was secretary, qualified secretary, and then they put Tom Fishburne on there, and he stuck around for a couple of months, and then he quit and went back to school, and good night. Each time somebody quit, I'd have to go back in and straighten out that mess. They knew they was going to go on. They didn't really keep up. And then Charlotte Giffen came in on it, and she stayed there for about 5 years, I believe. Anyway, when Carl took over, it was new to him. In all due respect to him, and I was out in the lab, I didn't really know. I was over near the building. I don't really know what went on, but he'd get behind on his work, logging it out. I used to log it out for Baird. I'd logged it out for a year. When Carl come on, I don't know what his instructions are. Never did know. But anyway, he'd get behind logging out that data. They didn't let Charlotte log it out. She wasn't familiar with the lab procedures. After it got to her, then she'd mail it. But to check the data over, they didn't let her do that. At least at first. They may have done later, but at first they didn't. And so it was all up to Carl, and it'd stack up and stack up and stack up, and we were pretty busy. And if Carl would take a day off or vacation or sick leave or whatever, that Delmar would come get me, take me over there and say, now you straighten out this and get this all logged out and get this all caught up. If you have to stay over, you do it, but don't you leave till you've got it done, if it takes till tomorrow morning. Well, when Carl, I'd do that, and the next day when Carl had come back, the first thing he'd do is he'd come over there, what happened to my desk? And I'd tell him, and he'd just fume. He didn't want me doing that. And I said, I don't want to do that, but what do I do with Delmar? Well, and I told Del, I said, all you're doing is causing trouble between me and Carl. Don't worry about it, I'll handle it. But he never did say anything about it. Yes, as near as I know. Anyway, every time that whole next year or better, every time Carl would leave, then I'd have to go straighten out his desk. And that'd just make him just fighting mad. But there wasn't anything I could do about it, and he didn't do anything about it. If he kept the desk caught up when he left, well, it wouldn't have happened. But anyway, so there got to be a little nonsense between us. Now, I always respected Carl, but by golly, he and I clashed quite often, and that was kind of the basis of it. So when it come around the year to go after Jed, I wanted to go get Jed off mission. I tried to go get Ray, and that was in the wintertime, and there was a blizzard on, and couldn't get there. And I, you know, and Ray was getting ready to get married when Glenn come home, and that old car couldn't swim anyway, and I couldn't drive it to England, and so we bypassed that. But here was Jed out in Maine, and I wanted to go get him. And so I had to write to the church, tell him I wanted to pick that boy up, and what day should I be there. And I kept asking Carl, I need at least 2 weeks or better off, right the last of June, to go get Jed. Carl kept shaking his head, we got too much work to do, you can't go. Well, I didn't think we had that much to do, and anyway, I didn't believe him, and one day Carl wasn't there, and so I went to Delmar, and I said, hey, I gotta find out, but I'm trying to get up the courage to go get Jed. And Delmar said, if you want to go get Jed, you just go back there on that overtime sheet and on that calendar, and you write in the days you want. And you can have that time off, and if you run out of, and you don't get back on time, I'll carry you on non-comp. You've got no problems. And I said, well, Carl keeps telling me I can't go. And he said, you go put that down there, and if he gives you any static, come back to me. Well, the next morning, of course, I wasn't real sure. Well, Carl was all ticked off. You never really knew whether he was serious or whether he wasn't, but it all ended up the same. So the next morning he said, I see you wrote all those days down for vacation, and I told you you couldn't have them. And I said, yesterday I had to know, because I had to write to the church last night for permission to pick Jed up. And I asked, you wasn't here, so I asked Delmar, and Delmar said I could go. And he said, yeah, but I said you can't. And so with that, I grabbed him and drug him up the hall to face Del. And he done everything he could do and finally talked me into stopping. I was the biggest. No. Carr, since he's been taken out as boss, I've tried to get along with him. We've kind of got around. And I was kidding him last night that last time I had that desk, he fired me, and he just turned around. He never said a word, so... And I hope he reads this. He don't sue me, but anyway, I got to get ready to go to work. I was on graveyard shift the month as we... I can't remember whether we left on a Monday or on a Tuesday, but anyway, the night I went out there, graveyard shift, so 8 o'clock that morning I would have had that day done, and I was working on that shift with Mark Emai, a Japanese boy who was a technician with us, and Craig Chapman. They were both graduate college men, and they later went back and got their master's degrees and have left the company, and I haven't seen them in a long time. I enjoyed working with them. Anyway, I met them in Logan. One of the kids took me to Logan. I met them and went out to work and worked graveyard. And then over on that corner in Brigham City where the road comes down out and turn down out of the canyon around to the south and then met the road. This was before that section of freeway was in, and then you turned south and went past that Texaco station where we generally gassed up. And there I waited for my wife and kids. When I left to go to work that night, I didn't really know whether Julia was going to go or not. She'd said all the time she wouldn't go. And one day she said, "No, I'm not going. We don't have the money to go." I said, "I know. I went up to the bank and borrowed $700 to go." I said, "I love you enough that I can't argue with you. But you can change your mind and go with us until we're down the road far enough that you can't catch us." So when I left, it was Judy and Neil and Nancy and Gary and Julie and I going after. We were going in that 65 Buick that I had bought from Faber and Heisel a couple of years before. We put this luggage carrier on the top, and we had everything all lined up, and so we were ready to go. We planned to stop. Had our sleeping bag. Everybody had a sleeping bag. We had Coleman stove along, so we could stop the side road and cook our dinner, or cook our breakfast, or whatever. And so I waited on that corner that morning, and I waited and I waited. Mark and Craig went over to the restaurant and got their breakfast and come back and stopped there and heckled me that they had gone on without me, and I might as well go home with them. No, I said I believe my wife's decided to go, and I have to wait for her. So. Seems like it was about 10 o'clock when they showed up. And I was glad they were there, never said a word. We just got in the car, and I stayed awake till we got the kids on the road to head up Weber Canyon. Then I went to sleep and slept up Weber Canyon and out across the first part of Wyoming. Wasn't anything there to see anyway. But we camped that first night out about halfway through Nebraska. And the next day we went into Omaha, crossed the river to Council Bluffs, then went north to winter quarters over there to Council Bluffs. I remember we stopped and had some ice cream. When we get up the country to Council Bluffs, to Winter Quarters, Julia said, "You know where my purse is?" And I said, "I guess it's back there where we had the ice cream." So from then on, we made her leave the purse in the car. If she wanted something out of it, she'd get it out. She didn't. We left the purse in the car. So we turned around and went back and got it. Now, over the years, I've chased her purse all over the country trying to find where she left it. There were some of those places I wasn't going to get back to. So we got it, visited it, and went up and saw the sights at winter quarters. Went through the park, went over the Marmon Bridge. Toll Bridge. Then headed east across to Iowa. Guys, that's pretty country. The eastern half of Nebraska and across to Iowa was a lot better country than the Mormons ever found after they got to the mountains. But they had to come here for another reason. I've wondered why the church came, why the Lord brought them out here. But finally, John Taylor, I read where he said that the reason they came to the mountains was that they had to raise a generation that could stand it. Every place they'd stopped before, the devil had dug them out. And they needed a place. And so when they got to Salt Lake, they scattered people clear down that to the south, clear into Mexico, and clear from the Salt Lake to the north into Canada. Well, about 1,000 miles each way, and manned every stream, and got on every little brook, and built a commonwealth, and a place to raise a new generation. And the Lord granted them enough years of peace to do that. Now the church is established well enough, they can go anywhere. But anyway, back to our story. We went across to Iowa, and gosh, that was pretty farming country. Had a little farming blood strong in me, and I remember as we got to Davenport, Iowa, across the river, I think it's a Mississippi right there. Anyway. Then we had to swing to the south to hit the freeway, and as I hit that freeway and headed east, I pulled out to pass a truck. This truck driver waved, he reached out and waved his hand down, so I slowed up and went back in behind him. As we got up over that hill, there was a highway blockade checking speed and everything else. I remember Julia said, gosh, I thought he was just waving at us. And I said, yeah, but he don't do those for just common, ordinary things. I always appreciate him. Never knew him, never met him, but courtesy of the road was quite a thing. Everybody should help everybody that's on the road for their betterment. Anyway, we went on across, and as we were getting about to, we'd go along and stop and cook our supper when we got hungry or go to a store. We always had some milk and always had something to eat along. We took a little meat in that cooler we had in the trunk. So we had our own grub for a day or two, and we stopped and cooked supper. Hey, let's see how this comes. After we'd had our supper, then we headed on for Chicago. And we got just out of Chicago and pulled into a campground, a KOA campground. We stopped at KOA or one of their competitors. That's where we'd stayed in Nebraska. It was a little campground. And gosh, you could pull in there just about dark and drive that car up into a slot that we'd rented for, well, anywhere from $3.50 to $6. I think generally it was around $4, $4.50. We'd pull right up right in front of that car. Neil and I'd put that tent up while the rest of them got somewhere and got to the bathroom and got squared around. We'd put that tent up and blow up those air mattresses, and everybody had an air mattress. We generally put Gary in the car to sleep. Neil said he'd sleep at the door of the tent to protect everybody, and me and the Julia and the two girls slept in the tent. Those spooky girls, I never did forget that. Anyway, that was the general procedure. And the next morning, everybody, sometimes either night or morning, everybody'd have a shower and shampoo and brush your teeth, and we'd cook breakfast and take that tent down, roll that tent up and put it in and let the air out of those air mattresses and roll up our sleeping bags and get ready to go. And I think we finally slid that luggage carriage as far to the front of the car as we could go, and then we put the, for balance, I think we put the tent up in the front of that. And that was where we had to kind of balance it so we could drive it. You get too much weight on the back end of that car, and then you couldn't drive it. Didn't have enough weight on the front end. And so we headed out and left. Took the freeway loop around Chicago and took a good look at it, and then headed east. Got up there and crossed into Michigan and over to Detroit. Crossed over into Canada and then went up the St. right on the Canadian side, the St. Lawrence Freeway. And we had an appointment for Jed that following Saturday at noon in up in Maine, that little town up in Maine where he was. Anyway, I said, you be in your apartment at noon, your time. And I will either be there or I'll call you. So we went up the St. Lawrence Freeway and up, and we stopped and watched a ship go through the locks one time. That's kind of interesting to watch. We stopped up there and saw a few of the sights on the Canadian side. Went on clear up to Montreal. Then when we got to Montreal, we switched on His Majesty's Highway. At night, I'm glad that Her Majesty would take it, claim it. Then it cut across back in the United States, around through New Hampshire. That night we stayed, it was raining, and so we stayed at a motel. We'd get a motel room, and Julia and whoever got to the bed first, and the rest of us slept on the floor. Generally one or two of those girls get in bed there, and the rest of us sleep on the floor. But anyway, so the next day we headed right on up the country, and at noon we were in Bangor, Maine. So I went to the phone and called Jed, and I said, we're in Bangor, Maine, 50 miles away. I've missed it 50 miles. Now stick around. Why don't you go down on the main street? As we come into, gosh, I'd like to remember the name of that town. We came down and sat down there on a bench on the park, and he said, yeah, there's a bench right there, and we'll watch for you. And so as we left this store, we had gotten this far with just one set of keys for the car, and I didn't believe in traveling with just one set of keys. So we went in a Sears and Roebuck store and had some new keys made. And I had told Neil that he was the navigator, that he searched out the way to go and the road. We'd had some maps we'd bought from Texaco for the trip, so we'd know where we was going, and we'd figured out, and I'd made him the navigator. And as we stand there getting ready to check out of Sears and Roebuck store, had the keys made and a few other things we needed, I said to this lady, do you have a McDonald's here? And she said, no, we have a Carey's, which is about the same thing. And she started telling me and Neil how to get there. And of course, Julie and Judy and Nancy and everybody was listening. When she got through, I said to Neil, do you know now where she said to go? And he said, yes. And I said, all right, I believe I do too. And anyway, I got out and got in that car and started down the road there in this Bangor, Maine. And Julia and Judy was just yelling at me that I was going the wrong way. But I could hear Neil in the background saying, no, you're right, you're right. This is the right road. And they were just going. And I pulled right into Carey's, and they were still saying, you're going the wrong way. Well, what had happened? They'd got turned around. And of course, it wasn't them turned around. It was us turned around. And when I pulled in there, I said, is this all right? Is this good enough? Julia said it was an accident. Well, anyway, we got there and run in, and I don't know, there was some Shriners convention or something, a bunch of people with some gooky hats on, and they'd been drinking a little bit of the forbidden ointment, I believe. And I said, good night, you guys go back and get in the car, and Neil and I'll bring the hamburgers, and we bought enough hamburgers to go around and the drinks, and so we could get her dinner. We didn't take time to cook that time, and occasionally we lived this way. But then we headed up that country to Jed. And I remember as we pulled in, there sat Jed and his companion on that park bench. I turned to Carner and said, "Julia, there's your boy." Well, we jumped out and ran over to get Jed. And we went over to his apartment. And we had to go up into Canada to district conference that night. Well, can't remember the name of it. We'll have to put that in later. But we went up to district conference, and there we rented a motel. And that entitled us to swim. And Neil took his sleeping bag and went and slept with the missionaries. So Judy and Nancy and Julia and Gary and I stayed there. And we had to swim, and they had to swim and pool there, and some of them swam, I believe. And this was quite a thing, and we got to... Those missionaries fought around all night. Next day we were at the conference, and I remember they had... We met a girl that... down here in Utah that had gone out there to teach school. There was a couple of them out there teaching to university there. And we met some people, assistant to the president, was converted to the church, I think, by Bill Pond. Baptized into church by Bill when he was there on a mission many years before. And this was back in the mission field to me. Place I'd longed to go back, but never got there. And so they give Jetty's release, wished us well. Monday morning, I guess Sunday night, we went back to his apartment. We all stayed there. And Monday we left out. We loaded his stuff up, and I thought the car was full before. By the time we got Jed's stuff in there and Jed, it was fuller than it was before. And I remember Jed kept his tie on and his coat on and all right up, spruced right up to snuff. All the time we were in his mission field, we went down the country and stopped and saw a few people that he had been with in the church, helped bring into the church. I felt like Jed had had a good mission. And we camped over to the birthplace of the prophet. We got in there, it was a little dark, and just pulled in and camped. And I remember a car, a little car there, a couple of girls, I guess there was girls, there was a couple of kids anyway, in sleeping bags, right there on the table. And we just, I don't know if we put the tent up that night or not, I think we did, but anyway, we just camped. And next morning, there was a couple of girls in that car that come there, and they reared up, and they had never even heard us come. There were Mormon girls that worked in Washington, D.C., that were on vacation, touring around some of the church sites. Then we toured and had the lecture of the birthplace of the prophet. Then we headed out. The next night, we got to the Hill Cumorah. We got to the place where the church was organized. We'd been to the Sacred Grove that day. We'd been into Palmyra. Ate dinner up on the Hill Cumorah. Looked out over that flat as you thought about the battles that had taken place there. Two different civilizations died there in battle that we knew of, that we know of. And then when we got through with the sites there, and that was quite a thing, I went to the Sacred Grove. The Martin Harris home, we didn't go. That was under construction. So then we headed for Niagara Falls, and that's where we camped that night. We went down and saw Niagara Falls in the under the lights. And, hey, guys, that's quite a thing. They're real pretty. Stayed there that night and headed west the next morning, and we saw the sights as we could go along. And the next event was the Kirtland Temple. And as we got there and ready to go into the Kirtland Temple, and this was interesting to me, I said, "Jed, let's get as much information out of this guy as we can. He'll know we're Mormons." And he did. And we quizzed him down, and we got as much information as we could get out about that Kirtland Temple. And then we left and headed for Chicago. Just out of Chicago, west of Chicago, we camped the same place we camped when we was going out. Then the next morning, we headed south and went west a little while, and then went south down to Nauvoo. Seems like we stayed overnight at Nauvoo. And we went to Carthage. Now, maybe we went to Carthage on the way to Nauvoo. Anyway, while we were in the Carthage jail, as we got around to the tour and as we were seated in the room where the prophet was shot, and that ended the tour, I sat there and I waited for most people to leave. But this lady guide kept sticking around, and I finally discovered that she wasn't going to leave. So I said to my family, "In this room is probably the place where Joseph, the prophet, set apart Hiram to be president of the church." And good night, that lady guide come all over me. And I said, "Now, wait a minute, just calm down and let me tell my story. And when we get down there, if you've got the history of the church, I'll show you." And so I finished my story, and we discussed that. And we got down there and went to the, she tussled me right into the library. And I got out to volume 6 and showed her where that was the case. She turned to her husband and said, "Well, I've never heard this." He said, "Yeah, that's right, I've known that." And she said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And he said, "Well, don't know, never did think, had the need to know." But then that next day after we left Nauvoo, it was quite a thing. As we got into that Bureau of Information in Nauvoo, we looked at this one missionary, and it was Jim Cooper. He was Nate's age, played football. He was the transplant from California to Skyview that beat Logan for the first time. He outrun everybody, made touchdown, beat Logan. And he was there as a missionary. It's quite a thing to go around Nauvoo and see. And good night, I wondered if the mosquitoes were that bad when the pioneers were there, and it probably was worse. And as they're restoring that city, quite a thing. Here's where, when my ancestors, my great-grandfather and his family was coming across the river. They took my grandfather. He was an 18, 20-year-old boy, and that's about the way we'd have done it, I guess. And built a raft and loaded their cattle on this raft. They built a creel on there and run them in on that raft, and then fastened up the creel and pushed it out to get it across the river, and sent my grandfather on that raft, and the cattle got scared. Now, understand that the best time to cross a river was at a certain time so that the sun didn't glare. You had to either do it early in the morning or late at night, evening. I think early in the morning was the best, but anyway. They said as they pushed that raft out on the river with the cattle on it, and my grandfather on it to kind of steer it or whatever, to take care of it. And I imagine if we do the same thing, we'd pick out one of the kids and send him to do it. We're about like Lehi. If we're going to do something, we send one of the boys. Well, Granddad said in his history that they got out in that river and the cattle got excited, scared, and stacked up on one side of the raft and tipped the raft over and throwed him out. And he said he got a hold of an old cow's tail, hung on, and that's how he got across the river. So I guess we're here because of an old cow's tail. The river was about a mile wide right there, I think. At least it looked that wide to me. Then as we left Nauvoo and went down the river, I saw a sign that said down here so many miles, there was a ferry across the river. Now I see. I got a lot of static here, and I don't know why. I've stopped and cleaned it. So we'll proceed anyway. I'll try and talk loud enough to hear me above the static. But as we went on down the river, and we found the road that came up to this ferry, went across. Good land. We drove out on that ferry at our appointed time, and everybody got out of the car, and I remember Gary. He thought that was quite a thing. That water was just right down there, just a few inches away. And I think that was one of the highlights of his trip and all the rest of us. I'd ridden on a ferry years before, but it'd been a long time. And so we went across and then hit the road to go on across Missouri. We wanted to hit into Missouri, north of Independence, up at Adamondiomon. But when we got over in the Adamondiomon territory, we followed the road map and got off the road and went to Adamondiomon and went to where the sign was that said, "This is Adamondiomon." And my land, it was just raining so hard you couldn't even get out of the car. And I always wanted to go out and walk out around that Adamondiomon country, but we just couldn't do it. The road rains hard that you just couldn't survive. So then we looped around and got into Independence. Went to the Bureau of Information at Independence and took the tour there. We saw the duplicate of Liberty Jail. Somewhere we saw that along in that area. They told us about it. We saw the temple site where the temple is to be built in Independence. Then we sashayed around there in town a little while and went on out of town to the west, almost to Lawrence, Kansas, I believe. From there we bedded down for the night. Then the next day we headed west across Kansas. Oh, that was hot. My land. We'd go from road stop to road stop all day across Kansas. We'd stop and then we'd take a wet towel, put it around our neck. And that old Buick would boil. That was a rest stop about every 30, 40 miles. We'd pull in there and get the water and pour water down over the front of the radiator and let it cool the car off gradually and cool it off and cool her down. Fill it back up with water and then we'd get another 30, 40 miles. Julia and all the kids that wrap a wet towel around them or over their head or something to get what moisture we could. And that was the hottest day we ever spent, I believe. Then as we come across Kansas and hit into Colorado, I know it'd been standard practice along. After we got down to a half a tank of gas, we always hunted for another Texaco station. I carried with me a Texaco credit card and still do. And so we'd charge it all on Texaco. And so we'd fill up. And I remember we were just coming into Denver, Colorado from the east. And we were getting down there and on gas. So we turned into a Texaco station off the freeway, and he had a whole bunch of pumps there, and some said no gas at this one, but we lined up and got in line for a gas pump. And I said, "How many gallon will you sell me?" And he said, "We'll sell you all you want. All you can get in that tank." He said, "I've told my supplier that the day I run out of gas, I'm going to lock the door and go fishing." That's about, that was, that year was about like this year, 79. Everybody on the radio and television and so forth were yakking that there wasn't enough gas. We were going to run out of gas. They had this big scare, just like we got now. Man, it's a... So we filled up in Denver and comes on and on through Denver and on out to the north and started asking where should we stop? I think this was Sunday night. And everybody said, "Let's go home." It was Jed, Judy, and Neil and I took turns driving. So we headed up to Cheyenne and then headed west. Long out there in the middle of the night, we'd bought a set of tires from Levere just before we went. We ruined one of the tires out there in Wyoming, changed it, put the spare on, got into Ogden the next morning and stopped and traded that tire for another one. Bought a new set of tires, bought that one, and paid the difference, put it on, come on home. I was always glad I made that trip. It cost somewhere around $700 for the trip. There's no free lunch, you know. But I don't know when we'd ever in our lifetime been a better time for us to go and see the sites of the church, the historic places of the church, and to go clear across. And I remember one that we were over on the Atlantic Ocean, and Judy and Nancy run down there so they could stick their toe in the Atlantic Ocean. I believe one of them slipped and fell in. I don't remember which one. But so I throwed rocks in there. A few years ago, when Lyle got married, why, Craig and I and so forth, we went down to Lyle's wedding, and Craig and I went out and waded in the Pacific Ocean. So I've had both toes in both oceans. I was on a mission in St. Petersburg, Florida, stuck my toe in the Gulf of Mexico. So I didn't really go swimming, but I just stuck my toe in the blue. Well, that's restless.